Thanks, Joe. Your comments are good. I think there's always areas to improve. We have put on our team has put high on our agenda to work closely with the inspections process and to ensure that we're getting the maximum amount out of that coordination. So your point is well taken, and we will look to see be as informed as we can be from the inspections process to inform our standard setting. It's an excellent point, one we are aware of, and one we'll continue to work to improve our information gathering on. Thank you. Gary Kaberick.
Thank you. Marty, I have about four unrelated comments to each other, but for the most part they're builds on earlier discussions here, and they're really in no particular order. But the first one is, and I think what Joe just mentioned about you have the inspections. I don't recall in the 2 years I've been on SAG if we've ever had someone from the inspection unit actually present to us. Maybe they have, and I've missed. My memory isn't quite what it should be, but I don't think it would hurt for the SAG to get a 30 or 60 minute just presentation from the inspection office. Just, I read the reports in the major firms, but just to synthesize and pull it all together as opposed to reading individual reports and just say, at the top of the PCRB house, what are the key messages inside of these inspection reports, sort of taken as a whole, and not the one-off, where someone just blew an audit, but just sort of systemic things. So that's a request. I think on what Lynn had talked about the audit standards alerts coming out, which I think is a very good idea. It works. I mean, the SEC regularly sends out Dear CFO type letters or Dear CEO letters. I would endorse it. My only ask would be, if you're going to do it for this year, do it sooner rather than later. As prepare, the last thing you need is on or about February 1st, a new audit test or direction coming out for the 2009 audit. So if you, I'm not saying if you should or should not do it, it makes sense to me you should, but I would say sooner rather than later, before it's so late in the game that it's really hard to kind of go back, once the staffs are starting to dissolve and move off the audits and stuff. Another thing that somebody earlier had mentioned, Madoff, and I don't know how the PCOB would deal with this, but you really start getting into the technical qualifications and the size of an auditing firm. He had a two- or three-person audit firm, and he's a $60 billion operation. And I don't know how you can decide when is the client too big or too complex for the auditee. It's not often a small firm grows to be huge, and the small auditing firm doesn't drop off along the way for a larger firm, but it does happen. I would suggest something along those lines as a possible standards project. And I actually don't know how you would go about saying a small firm just isn't up to the job, but it doesn't mean it's not worthy of some staff work on it. And then the last comment is in this hit me when I was reading, doing the pre-read on use of a specialist, but I began thinking about the Audit Advisory Committee, and our chairman was on it. And one of her comments was, and I don't know if it came up in the meetings, but certainly as I was prepping her for them, is about the accounting curriculum at the undergraduate level. Is it the right curriculum? I appreciate the state boards of accountancy control a lot of these things, the CPA exam, but really in every university to some extent has got flexibility in its agenda, but should the PCOB either in a white paper or position paper take a position, what do you think the model curriculum is for the current era? I get a sense in some ways it's in an industrial area curriculum, and I'm not saying that's true for any one university, but I get a sense as it's generally true, and say, should there be courses in risk-based decision-making? Should there be required courses in fair value measures, not the accounting, but how does an appraiser do his work, to understand appraisal methods, to understand better discounted cash flows, or what actuarial science, or just not to be an expert, but greater understanding. And I could go on for some other items as well. They don't have to be in accounting. They could be in economics or business math. Of course, the issue is, what do you drop? The student curriculums are busy. I don't know what you would drop. I would say a lot of the curriculums today have calculus, and I've never taken a calculus course. I've made it 35 years. It might be important in some places, but maybe the curriculums get longer. I mean, a lot of the states are 150 hours now, but can I think the board should take a position? What do you think the model accounting curriculum should look like for guidance to universities? Thanks.
Thanks, Gary. I've made note of your comments, and after we get a few more, a few remarks I'd like to make, but let me go around the table. Some other cards are up, but I'd also be interested in, when I get back to your comments, whether any of the professors here, academics, would be interested in talking about the accounting curriculum. Liz Bender.
Thank you. Two questions. Well, one comment. At the beginning, there was Greg Jonas, I think, raised the issue about the survey process that goes on at FASAC. And although I initially rolled my eyes a little bit because I've been on both sides of that, it was very helpful from a discipline standpoint, both as an FASB staff member and going through projects, and I think it's helpful as a discipline participant in this kind of process to actually try and go through a number of projects, for example, from 1 to 10. It's hard to do, but it is helpful in your own thinking as well. And my second completely unrelated comment was I would like to not leave Lynn Turner's concern that he raised earlier without response, and that was the one about a question or a concern about whether the SEC has limited PCAOB's budget. I think he referenced it in terms of a fraud center, but I think more broadly some response would be appropriate as to whether that's happening at all or whether it's from the SEC or from the PCAOB staff, if there's any further comment on that.
Thank you, and I'll get back.
Maybe I should comment on that. I mean, I think the discussion was in terms of the ACAP recommendations, and in this year's budget, we were essentially given what we asked for in terms of implementation of those recommendations. The budget order does ask that we consult with the SEC or keep them advised about what we're doing with respect to those recommendations, and we've done that. On the fraud center specifically, again, I think as Marty emphasized, we do regard that as a, I guess what I'd call a priority recommendation and something that has a real potential to benefit audit quality. We're going through a process now of collecting input suggestions from a number of people, including some around the table, as to exactly how the fraud center would best be structured and what its responsibilities would be, and you know, once we reach a conclusion about that, I'm sure we'll go back to the SEC and tell them what our conclusion is and what we see the budget impacts as being. But I don't think it's fair to say that they put any budget limitations on us with respect to that work.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any.
With respect to your other comment, Liz, thanks for putting an exclamation point. Greg made the point about FASAC and surveying the members to get information about standard setting, and how helpful he thought that was, and to have your exclamation point on the value of that is good input in terms of processes that we may want to put into place. So thanks a lot for that comment. And, of course, asking Joe Corsello to comment, the chances that he wouldn't respond are slim, so Joe...
No, I wasn't going to respond. I really wasn't. But since you asked, I'm the only accounting professor in the room. Jim's a law professor. So let me at least address some of the issues. We talked about this a good bit the first 2 years I was on the SAG. So for those of you who were there then, Vin and Randy and many others, you've heard this before. But what a lot of the general public doesn't understand is that the accounting curriculum at the undergraduate level, accounting faculty have really very little control over. The way it works is the first 60 hours in virtually every university is controlled by the College of Arts and Sciences. And guess what, guys? They have the votes. There's a whole lot more of them than there are business faculty. So they have the votes. That's just kind of how it works. And so that leaves at most 60 hours for the business school. And a significant number of those hours, usually 36 or so of those hours, are controlled by essentially survey classes in finance and management and marketing and statistics and economics and so forth. And again, compared to the accounting faculty, the rest of the College of Business, they have the votes. So we have, most universities, maybe 8 classes. And in those 8 classes, you have a survey class in auditing, a survey class in tax, a survey class in managerial, a survey class in systems. And so you have a few. The only area you have any depth at the undergraduate level is financial. And even there, it's not a whole lot of depth. And so at the undergraduate level, there's just a very limited degrees of freedom. There is more degrees of freedom at the Mac level. There's no question about that. But the proliferation of material that's coming out of the standard-setting bodies, PCAOB, SEC, IAASB, so forth, is just tremendous. And as Lynn and Damon and Galen and probably others remember, I testified as passionately and as persuasively as I could muster that essentially the education model in the United States is broken. And essentially argued for an education model really patterned much after law schools, Jim, where the PCAOB would be involved in issuing a national license for auditing of public companies. And as part of that oversight, they'd have oversight of the curriculum in these graduate schools of professional auditing. That recommendation somewhat watered down, but more included than I thought was likely to happen, went forward in the final report for the AAA and the AICPA to study a commission to consider the future structure of accounting education, which probably means nothing will happen, but that's where it is right now.
Jeff, thanks for that input. Damon Silvers?
Yes, well, good morning. I apologize for coming late. I hope that what I say won't sound silly. As a result of missing some of the earlier conversation. Two points. One is, you know, as a member of the Treasury's auditing committee, I guess, that agenda seems to be sort of percolating around this room. I just want to make two observations. One is that the recommendation for fraud center, which I gather Lynn was trying to sort of see where we stood on that, earlier. The recommendation for a fraud center was an attempt in among a highly diverse group of people to try to find a consensus. I mean, this was a consensus-oriented body to move, to get some forward motion on a set of concerns that have been, I think, raised by people coming from an investor perspective to this body since the inception of the PCAOB and since the very first meeting of this body. I gather somebody made reference to Madoff and so forth. To my mind, the weakness of the fraud standard, not the absence of the fraud center, but the weakness of the fraud standard is a continuing problem. It's a somewhat technical one, which I can only hold, the details which I can only hold in my mind, on the days that I've studied it. But this is a continuing sort of piece of unfinished business. And moving on the fraud center would certainly be some progress, but I hope that the board is cognizant, staff is cognizant of the fact that there is this piece of unfinished business here with the standard that, you helpfully provided us with all the history of the discussions of standard setting going back all these years. It's just constant feature. And the real world keeps reminding us how important it is to get this right. Secondly, with respect to Joe Carcello's just point just now, I just wanted to say that Joe's passionate presentation, as he put it, on the need for strengthening the training of auditors, the educational background of auditors, I listened closely to what he said in my former capacity, and to what some other people said about this. And I think Joe is generous to our committee in that I think that our recommendations only sort of scratched the surface of what I was convinced was a very deep problem. And I believe that going back again to the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley and the formation of this body, that, you know, re-professionalizing auditing was the key mission here. And I was convinced by what we did in that committee that part of that needs to be a kind of reprofessionalization of auditor education, training, qualifications, curriculum, and the like. Again, that was controversial to some degree because it would involve more resources, potentially more resources from academic institutions. Obviously, somebody would have to pay for that. In a sense, ultimately, more resources from the profession. But I think that this is a very important subject and one in which the PCAOB may have something quite significant to contribute, and where the board ought to be looking to try to figure out what that something is. I don't pretend to be expert enough to tell you exactly what to do about this. It sounds like Joe has some ideas, but I just wanted to lend my voice in support of the concerns he raised. Thank you.
Thanks for those comments, Damon. A couple of things have come up that let me just mention. It ties into Lynn mentioned before that the Auditing Standards Board had moved more rapidly in certain cases than the PCAOB had. And then it ties in a little bit with your comments on the weaknesses, as you see it, in the fraud standard. We do have the suite of risk assessment standards that we have proposed and plan to repropose, and there's a great deal of what's in those risk assessment standards that embed fraud and the assessment of the risk of fraud more into the audit process than as a standalone, hey, take a look at SAS 99 and think about fraud and have a brainstorming session. Those risk assessment standards are intended to really embed the fraud risk assessment process throughout the audit. So your comments are well taken on the need to continue to address fraud, and I think these risk assessment standards do that partially. There are other things as well, and when we get to the discussions later on today and some of the things in your briefing paper with respect to fair values and related parties, in both cases we teed up in there should there be a presumption of fraud risk in certain cases with respect to fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty or certain types of related party transactions. So rather than a one-off approach, not saying that maybe a one-off approach wouldn't also be good, but rather than just a one-off approach, as we're looking at other standards, fraud is being contemplated and fraud risk is contemplated in that standard-setting process. So it's high on our agenda, and as was mentioned by Dan also in his comment about the Fraud Center is high on our agenda, although it's not a current standard-setting project. Fraud Center, we're getting input from a variety of ways as to how that Fraud Center might be organized. So thanks for all those comments. They're very useful, very helpful. Randy Fletchall.
Thanks, Marty. I want to go back to Gary's comment about the piece having a view on accounting curriculum and education and Joe's comments and Damon's. I mean, one thing we have seen over the last couple of years, I guess, is a trend that while many states will still require 150 hours of education to be licensed as a CPA, a movement to only 120 hours to actually sit for the exam for many reasons. I won't use the phrase unintended consequences now that I know Lynn Turner has such an aversion to that, so I'll just try to say it in my own words, and it's, I hope we don't end up with the education, both in quality and sufficiency, of those who are entering the profession, becoming CPAs, suffers in any way, shape, or form as a result of that movement. I understand some of the reasons for it, but as I look back through this list of all the things that have been in front of this group since its inception, I keep reflecting back on how many of those went to the world's more complex, CPAs need more, not less, more subject matter, the depth and breadth of what you need to do to really practice in this arena. Lynn saying, you know, you need to be able to go toe-to-toe with CFOs and CEOs. I think it is very important that we stay focused on the education, both quantity and quality of those who are becoming CPAs have to succeed in the profession and do the job around audit quality that everyone demands and should expect.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Randy, for that input. A couple of cards popped up quickly. Gary, I still have notes from your comments earlier, which I was still intend to respond to.
Okay.
A couple of those points.
It, thank you. It, the in terms of, I'll call it longer-term standard setting, and by the way, looking at the agenda, the list you put out this morning for what you're working on, that's a pretty impressive list, and whether or not some items should be more prioritized on it or not, I'll leave it to the board, but I think if you accomplished, you know, the next year, three quarters of it, you're probably doing pretty well, you know, in terms of there's a lot on it. And again, I won't argue should audit reports beyond it in lieu of something else, I won't say there, but there's, I think, this is a pretty aggressive list, is my observation. And I wish you well in getting through most of it on the times indicated. But reflecting on some comments that came out of last week's FASAC meeting, and actually, I made them. That's why I feel strongly about them. But this is going towards audit standard setting is you look at the volume of convergence projects that are coming, and whether you go in a big bang in a couple of years or a couple of projects, big projects a year for the next several years. I mean, I had asked for the FASB to be as flexible as you can on transition rules, whether retroactive restatement, cumulative effect, but I think there might be a few years of inconsistencies among big companies, but with the volume coming, we're asked for some flexibility, and the other preparers in the room agreed with me on it. So I think, so let's assume, for the sake of discussion, a lot of these standards are deemed to be retroactively applied for, say, 3 years, or you've got five-year tables, you know, maybe not audited, but five-year tables. Well, you know, my experience when you try to retroactively restate items because of a change in accounting, as you go back, the further back you go in time, one, it's harder to recreate records that were current and available physically as well as in people's mental consciousness. If the further and further you go back, the ability to do it as precisely and accurately as you could for the current year, it starts deteriorating. You know, and through no fault of anyone else, so the memories fade and the records necessarily aren't retained. So you wonder, then you go say, gee, a restated three-year-old disclosure in a footnote can't not be as relevant in many cases as the current, you know, revised disclosure. So the ask is, should there be a project about how do you go about auditing restatements, you know, given that I expect there's going to be a lot of them coming for change in accounting principles, and is the three-year-old data, you know, arguably five-year-old data in a five-year table not audited, but you probably have comfort on it. How relevant is that, and how should an auditor react, you know, to that? Again, I don't think it's a critical thing to get on the short path right now because there's enough there and this is a ways out, but sort of longer-term project suggestion.
Thanks, Gary. Galen Hansen.
I want to just go back to some of the discussion that we've had about education. And Randy, I think when you were talking, you're talking about states going back to 120. I think you meant to sit for the exam. I didn't quite catch that. But most of the states, if not all of them, except for mine, has got a 150-hour requirement now where the holdout, much to my dismay and embarrassment, I might add. On the Treasury Committee, I listened to what Joe had to say also very carefully, and I thought it was very passionate. It was quite convincing. With the CPA exam, we don't try to teach to that test. We try to see that a person is educated. There has been a call for studies on 120 to sit versus 150 to license. And NASBET has posted a white paper on their website. There has not been a conclusive argument to say that someone should not be able to test it 150 hours. The evidence just doesn't say that the person won't be as good a CPA if he tests at 120 hours. Now, I have some misgivings about that, but that does seem to be a trend. But more and more information, as Joe pointed out, is coming. In 2011, now we're going to be testing on international accounting standards, and I do think that the PCOB, it would make some sense to weigh in on this this whole subject of what should be in a model curriculum, not to pass the CPA exam, but what it is that is going to educate a young person to be able to be successful in this business and contribute to audit quality. And I might add that the supervisors are not up on international accounting standards also.
I'm sorry. The supervisors?
The supervisors. You can test these young people, but who's going to supervise them with respect to application of accounting standards? And I guess with that, in that respect, who's going from the PCOB, who's going to inspect the successful application of those standards in practice?
Larry Salver.
So Galen's comment is kind of a perfect lead-in to mine, because while we're focused on the curriculum for sitting for the exam and for being licensed, what we really have to focus on is the continuing professional education requirements to stay in the profession, because it's actually the supervisors and the more senior people making the calls and you know, as Galen said, reviewing it. So I know I didn't get a heavy dose of valuation theory in college. I did get some in continuing professional education. But since most of those requirements are driven by states and very inconsistent in terms of, you know, what's required and the types of courses that might be required in CPE, requirements really need to be focused on as well.
Thanks for those comments, Larry. Let me try to not respond certainly to all of the comments that were made, but there are a couple of points I would like to touch on. One of the agenda items, and this goes directly to your point, Larry, one of the items on our current standard-setting agenda, number 12, deals with the applicability of SEC practice section requirements to all registered firms. Some of those matters in that SEC practice section deal with such things as continuing professional education. So that project will be addressing, to some extent, that point. But further on the issue of both licensing and continuing professional education, and this isn't really a response to the points that were made, but it is a further indication of some of the challenges with respect to that point. Our scope at the PCOB is to register all firms that perform audits of companies that file with the SEC, and of course that includes many firms that are outside the United States. All companies that audit foreign private issuers file with the SEC, they register with us and we inspect those audits, and certainly those auditors are subject to not only state, not state requirements here, but they're subject to whatever the requirements are of that particular country. And so therefore the issue you're raising about, that's been raised a couple of times about education and audits in connection with that are filed with the SEC and our purview over that deals not only with the U.S. and state matters, but auditors generally who audit financial statements that are filed with the SEC inside the United States or outside are part of our scope, just complicating that issue a little bit. With respect to a point that Gary made earlier, and that was should inspections make a presentation at a SAG meeting at some time in the future, I can't respond to that question in total. Of course, the charter of the SAG essentially goes to standard setting, but I will say inspections does try to give comments on a broader basis than just individual inspection reports, Gary, as I'm sure you're aware, through the 4010 reports that they periodically issue. And those reports are thematic in that they deal with not just an individual inspection of an audit of a particular firm, but what is the inspection division seeing broadly? And we've issued 4010 reports with respect to observations on the audits of fraud. Recently we just issued a 4010 report on the initial adoption of AS5 and audits of internal control over financial reporting under AS5. again, broadly, observations pertaining to that. And other 4010 reports were issued with respect to observations with respect to inspections of large firms. Those are those who inspect more than 100, those who audit more than 100 issues annually, and another inspection, 4010 report on small firms. So inspections, we do try to get out from the PCAOB more of these thematic findings of what's coming up from inspections through the 4010 reports, but your point is well made. I just tried to indicate that we do that in some respect. With respect to the comments Lynn made and then you made about getting out some commentary on an alert, I think Practice Alert 3 did deal with a lot of the risks, including fraud risks, that are in the environment today, including the greater incentives for fraud risk as a result of the pressures to meet numbers or just to stay in existence, as well as even the opportunity for fraud because many companies cut back on employees and reduced back office, which would have a further risk of fraud. But having said that, we're certainly going to take a look at other issues that, such as the allowance for loan losses or other issues that may need additional guidance at this point in time. I think in the last comment I'd like to make, and I don't know if there's any other cards up, the last comment I'd like to make is, I guess, another comment Gary made about the Madoff situation. And as you know, you may have pointed out, of course, that auditors of broker-dealers were not registered with the PCAOB, and those auditors, therefore, were not registered with us or subject to inspection by us. That's partially been changed such that auditors of broker-dealers are now required to register with us, although we don't have inspection authority yet with respect to those auditors. On your point of the risk of a very small firm auditing a larger company, very small audit firm auditing a larger company than it may be able to handle, an interesting point with respect to standard setting that you're making there, and we'll think about that, or quality controls potentially is where that might fit in terms of the quality control standards and the ability to staff an assignment. But I will also point out that in our inspections process, a risk-based approach is taken, and was mentioned by Dan that I previously headed our Office of Research and Analysis, and Joe St. Denis heads that now. We work closely with inspections, at least in our own work, when we're undertaking inspections, we look for risks like that. So where the audit might be done by a firm that looks very small vis-a-vis the company that they're auditing, or many other types of risks. So one of the things that we do here at the PCAOB in inspecting audits is to try to take that kind of risk-based approach that you're talking about in the comments that you made. With that, I think we're at the... I'm sorry, there's one more before our lunch break. Damon Silvers.
I just wanted to respond to a couple of things you just said. First is, I mean, I think we need to be clear on what the sort of genesis of this fraud problem is. The PCAOB had to adopt the AICPA standards as a practical matter when it came into being, because otherwise there would have been no standards. This was something that I think a number of us at the time, back in 2003, reluctantly recognized had to be done, even though we felt that those standards were in many cases deficient. And I think that the fraud standard was perhaps, and Lynn may disagree, there may be something worse, but the fraud standard may have been among the areas where there was the greatest concern. While it's true that the Madoff audit firm was not regulated by the PCAOB, it was subject, I believe, to the same AICPA standard. And thus, the continuation in the public company context of that standard is problematic, right? And particularly problematic in that it appears that, at least I'm sure this is their defense lawyer's position, that the Madoff accountant was in fact complying with it. That's just not where we ought to be, where this board ought to be. I'm a politically practical person. I understand all that, all the obstacles in the way of doing something about this over the years. But that hole is still there and needs to be addressed. Secondly, I note and am pleased with the concern about the current environment for issuers and pressures to commit fraud in the context of economic crisis weak financial institutions and the like. I know we're going to probably get into this later in the day, but I'm in a different capacity. I have been deeply involved in the review in an attempt to sort of understand the financial health of our major financial institutions. It is not possible today to answer the following question by looking at the financial statements of our major banks. And I can tell you it's not possible because a staff of 15 people hired by the Congress of the United States, consulting with the best academic experts we could find, could not answer it. And the question is, what is the dollar amount face value of toxic assets on the bank balance sheets? Now, the fact that you can't answer that question by looking at bank financial statements, it's not clear to me that constitutes fraud, but it seems to me it constitutes some serious problem in relationship to the financial statements of very large and important public companies. So I would commend to you the August report of the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP, which attempted to answer this question and couldn't answer. And I would also commend to you our report on the stress tests, which engages a similar set of issues.
Great. Thanks for those recommendations, Damon. And before I break for lunch, we'll have another comment from Lynn Turner. Thanks, Lynn.
Just real quick, because I'm the first one that likes to get in the food line. So I think Damon is directly on with his comments. The fact that we have the situation with the toxic assets he described is a humongous serious shortcoming in standards, and the fact that our accounting standards that are in this country hasn't rectified that decades ago is very problematic. The fraud standard he's directly on point didn't work when it came in. The fact that it hasn't been fixed is a serious shortcoming. But people around the table have mentioned the Madoff auditor, and I would hope that no one would paint the auditing profession with Madoff auditor. Here was a guy who was out on his own, had no work papers. In fact, he shouldn't even be called an auditor. He shouldn't even be called a member of the profession. This was a lone cowboy and lone wolf, and I cringe when I hear people try to paint the profession with this Madoff auditor, because he was no part of the profession, didn't follow any of the standards. It had no issue to deal with standards whatsoever. It was just basically a guy collecting cash and not doing his job, and it's as simple as that.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for your comments, contributions, and input this morning, which I assure you is very valuable to us in our standard-setting process and will be incorporated in our thinking. As I mentioned before, we feel accountable to we receive your input, we appreciate it, but we also look forward to getting back to you with respect to our response to your input in due course. Thanks again, and now's lunch, and we'll be back at 1 p.m.